want to let you know that it's being recorded. And our first order of business is for community input. Is there any community input this evening?
You'd like me to give you some community input?
Well, this is the time, yes.
Good evening. My name is Michael Pegler. I'm the executive director of the ARC. And I'm pleased to say that we've been through a really rough couple of years financially. And we've managed to reduce our debt significantly. And we've been approved to refinance the remaining debt. So we'll have a balanced budget probably within 2 weeks.
Congratulations.
We're back in business. We plan on, once the financing goes through and everything's signed, we're going to do a celebration at the Kickens Theater, kind of a coming out party and show a movie around supporting people with developmental disabilities.
Cool.
And try to seek more members and recruit board members. And we're adding, hope to add a couple of new programs. And I actually feel this is the first time since I've been at the ARC that I've been able to look forward rather than backwards. but we're going to hopefully add a program called Housing Coordinator, where we match people with disabilities whose SSI, SSDI is $780 a month. As you can imagine, it's very difficult to live on that. We suspect there's a high number of homeless, or near homeless, or underhoused people in this place, and we're going to try to match people in units so that they can afford to live, have an affordable place to live, and that has their life. So, thank you for your input on that. And so, anyway, things are moving forward, and we're back in the game, and I'm really excited. I think the most inspiring thing for me has been, it's probably kept me here, is even if we didn't have any money and we ran out of money completely, I think 80% of the staff would still show up. Just because the dedication and the endearing qualities of the people that we serve. It's just so inspiring. And, I truly believe that. And so, it's a great place to work. Anyway, great. Thank you.
Will you let us know the date of the celebration?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for your service. I don't think it would happen without your leadership. Thank you.
It just seemed like every rock I turned over, I thought, oh my gosh. A few mistakes were made a few years back. Put us in a hard spot. We're here and we're strong. We're also, I should tell you, I'm very, very hesitant to get involved, but Multnomah County and Clackamas County are dissolving their ARCs, and they want us to take them over. And my first comment was, I'm just climbing out of a black hole right now. The last thing I want to do is jump in another one. But we're going to look at ways that maybe we can partner on the strength-based basis. So we're not taking any unnecessary risks. And then I got a letter today from the Washington State Attorney General, who's investigating Savers and the way they conduct business, and other like entities that collect clothing and sell in the marketplace. There's going to be a large investigation for anyone that's collecting and selling these clothes, soft goods.
Does that include Goodwill? Because the National Department of Justice is going after them.
Yeah, I don't know.
They're investigating what, did you say?
Savers, which is thrift store that, you know, we collect clothes, used goods, and we sell them to Savers, and that's primarily where we get a lot of our money. And, They're under investigation by the Attorney General's office.
At this point, do you still recommend giving to?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think it started in Minnesota, and it pertains to some practices that other savory organizations. But I think it's an opportunity for a good journalist to investigate all those types of facilities. Goodwill, Savers. I think it would be a really good way for people to know, if you want to donate these goods, where's the best place that works locally and goes the farthest, would be really good information for people. So we're sort of welcoming the opportunity to have a look and see what people are doing.
I was just thinking of you tonight along those lines, thinking of the art, because as I was going out the door to my office, my receptionist was carrying a box, and another paralegal was saying, she was saying, I'm doing a purge at home, so I need this box. And I was like, well, everybody's posting on Facebook about their, you know, New Year's purges and whatnot. And my paralegal said, I have a bag in my car for Goodwill. And I said, you know, would you please call the ARC? Call the ARC. And they'll pick up from your doorstep if you call them. And they have drop-off spots, too. And so it made me think of you guys, and I wanted to go home and again kind of start getting the word out and remind people as we do these beginning of year cleaning and purges.
I think our local situation here is fairly clean, but see.
Yeah.
So stay tuned. I'll keep you informed. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
So if we don't have any more community input, we're moving on to Clark County Consolidated Plan. Keaton Rowe.
Thank you. Every 5 years, because Clark County receives entitlement money from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, we have to update our consolidated plan, which is our plan that guides how we're going to spend community development block grant funds and home investment partnership funds in Clark County outside the city of Vancouver. Vancouver has their own process for this and their own consolidated plan. So tonight I just want to give you a brief update on where we are in that plan, talk about some of our goals and priorities, and ask for your input. And I'm going to do kind of a high-level view here rather than getting down to the very specifics. The first thing I wanted to review is just the... Sure.
It was working with Janet.
The first thing I want to do is just review with you a little bit about the incomes that we're talking about. When I go through this, I'm going to be talking about people who make 30% of the area median income. And area median income is the metropolitan Portland, Vancouver, Hillsboro area. So, for example, if you look at that for a one-person household, the 30% of the area median income for 2014 is only $14,600. You go up to 50% is $24,300. 80% of the area median income is $38,000, and finally, 100% of the income for the metropolitan area is $48,550. And you can see as the household size increases, this area median income also goes up. So, thank you. One of the things that we can do with the CDBG funds is we can do projects in areas that are deemed low and moderate income. And HUD takes census data, they crunch it their own special way, and then determine which areas are low and moderate income. And these are the areas that have actually been determined as of this year to be, the years on that are not correct. It's actually 2014. These green areas are what are considered low and moderate area income. Low and moderate income areas. And so we can do various area activities there that would benefit the neighborhood or the particular community. And as you can see, there are certain areas of Washougal and Camas that are low income, a few areas of Battleground, a small area of La Center, none of the Richfield area is low and moderate income, and then all of the town of Yackel is low and moderate income. The other way that we can benefit people with the CDBG and home funds are if their household income is at a certain level, and you can check that by looking at documentation that people would provide, their income statements, property or income tax statements, and so on. The other way is some people are presumed to be low and moderate income under these programs, and that would include the elderly, which is 62 or over, the disabled, whether it's physically or mentally disabled, migrant farm workers, the homeless, and people who do not speak English. So there's a lot of people that we can benefit through these programs. Thank you. So I'd like to, at this point, just show you what's happened in the metropolitan area with income and rents and household sales prices from 2007 to 2014. So the first bar on the left shows the percentage increase in median family income as reported from HUD between 2007 and 2014. As you can see, it goes up about 9%. During the same period, the median family rent, the fair market rent for the two-bedroom apartment went up basically 25%. And at the same time, the median home price in Clark County has gone down about 14%, according to the University of Washington Real Estate Center. So as you can see, rents have gone up very fast, and much faster, almost three times as fast as median family income. Thank you. This shows the owner and renter income, household income in Clark County. This is all of Clark County right now. And I've broken it out by the lowest color is people who have a median family income between less than 30%, and then we have 31 to 50%, 51 to 80%, 81 to 100%, and then over 100%. And so as you can see, there's lots of people who are homeowners that have higher income, as you might expect. And as you can see for the renters, almost half of those housing, or half of the households that are renting have incomes less than 50% of the area median income. And again, obviously there are fewer renters than there are homeowners in all of Clark County. Thank you.
When you say Clark, you include Vancouver and all?
I'm including Vancouver in all this because you folks cover the whole county. So at this point, I'm covering the whole county. This looks at the cost burden that households have to deal with, renter households have to deal with. And a cost burden is defined as somebody who's paying between 30 and 50% of their income for their housing, and you have severe cost burden where people are paying more than 50% of their household income. So for example, if you're a renter and your household income is $1,000 a month and you're paying more than $500 a month for your housing, you would be in a severe cost burden situation. And as you can see by the colors on those graphs, as your income goes up, there are fewer and fewer people that are cost burden, either severely or just plain cost burden. But if you look at particularly the people under 30% area median income, there's very few of those folks that are living in affordable rental housing. Most of them have severe cost burden. And these are the folks that something goes wrong financially, they have a medical issue, whatever it may be, they lose their job. They are the closest one to potentially being homeless because they just don't have the money to pay for the rent. Now, I've done the same thing for homeowners in Clark County, and as you can imagine, there are not many homeowners that have very low income. And again, as you see, as you go up in your income, the housing becomes more affordable. Part of this is for some people who have paid off all their mortgages, their housing is very affordable because they really have very little costs except in utilities. But again, as you can see, for those people who have very low income, they do have some cost burden and severe cost burden, even as homeowners. And again, this creates problems depending on where you do something that's wrong with your home. They have to do lots of repairs. It puts them in a very difficult financial burden and puts them in risk of losing their housing.
Can you tell me about HAMF?
That's HUD, Area Median Family Income. This one, these next few slides, I'm going to show a breakout just for the rental housing, but I want to show the housing available for renters and by income. So, again, this is kind of a duplication of a slide I showed previously, but this shows the percentage of renter households by, again, this income rate. So you see about 20% of the renters in Clark County are 0 to 30% of the area median income. 30 to 50% are almost 20%. This slide and the next two and the next one are not in the packet. So you can see this is the income of the households that are renting. And if we do the next slide.
Yes, the two put together.
Yes. This slide shows rental units in Clark County and what they would rent for based on the percentage of area median income. So for example, the first slide shows that there are about 8% of the rental units have rents that are affordable to people at 0 to 30% of the area median income. The next one shows that almost 20% of the units are available for people who have incomes between 30 and 50%. Then the largest one is again 50 to 80%, and there are a smaller percentage of rental units for people at 80% of the area median income or above. So when you think about this, you're thinking if they're 20% of the households have incomes from 0 to 30%. Are 20% of the rental units available, affordable to those folks? So you'd have a good match between income and rental units. And if you would hit the button, you can see that there is not a good match. So again, if you look at the left-hand slide, the lighter bar, kind of the orange one, that's the number of renters. And the darker colored one is the number of rental units that are affordable to those folks. So a large proportion of those folks are not going to be able to rent those units. They're going to have to either go to the next higher rental range or even the higher one. And as you can see, there's an excess of units that rent to people between 50 and 80%. Another unique thing about the mismatch of this, and obviously there's some people that are paying more than they should for rent, but some people have very high incomes that are paying very low rent. But one of the statistics I dug up is that there are 480 renter households with an income over 100% of the area median income that are renting units that rent to people from 0 to 30%. So they're getting an incredible deal that there are 480 people in Clark County, households in Clark County, that complete reverse mismatch.
So they're renting low income.
They have a very high income and they're renting in an apartment that would be affordable to very low income people. Now I'm going to go on just a little bit for homelessness, and this is the county point in time for sheltered and unsheltered households from 2005 to 2014. As you can see, it's been a steady downward trend in the number of people who are sheltered and unsheltered. Part of this is due to the document recording surcharge money that we began to collect, and now Clark County collects over $3 million a year, that money that can go towards alleviating homelessness based on our homeless plan. And Andy will talk about the homeless plan in a few minutes. We also developed our first homeless plan in 2005. It had implementation and strategies involved in it. And so that's one of the reasons this is going down over time. In 2014, the point in time homeless subpopulations that we've identified, and this is some of them, I just wanted to point out, this is self-identification, but who some of the people are and some of the subpopulations. So for people, self-identification in 2014 point in time cap, which was in January, 9% of the people said they were chronic homeless individuals. 17% said they had severe mental illness. 8% were chronic substance abuse users. 7% were veterans, and 17% said they were victim of domestic violence. So they self-reported, and some people reported more than one category. And 72% of the persons in homeless families with children who are under the age of 18.
Pete, may I ask a question?
Yes.
Is this self-reporting?
Yes.
So this is what a homeless person would report?
When they're interviewing, yes, self-reporting.
Did you say some said two?
Yeah. So
they're given in both. Yes, reporting both.
Yes.
Pete, did you mean by that last bullet point the children were under the age of 18?
Yes.
If the children are over the age of 18, are they allowed into the family shelters?
I'm going to defer to Andy on that.
If there are no children under 18, they're not considered a family.
In what?
If they're, well, unless the adult child is dependent in some other way.
So let's say
it was a 4-year-old and a 20-year-old son, that would not be considered a family.
Unless the son was disabled.
Yes. Not just disabled, but
So now I'm just going to move on quickly to our draft priority needs that we're going to have on our new consolidated plan. We're going to have your three needs. There is affordable housing development and preservation, community and neighborhood sustainability, and the alleviation of homelessness. And under the affordable housing development and preservation, we have...
So alleviation, does that include prevention?
Yes. Under these goals, we have three goals under this priority. We have increased housing supply, and that's the rent of households at 60% of the area median income or below. We have preserved housing, and this could be either home ownership or rental housing. We have a homeowner rehab program that we've had going for about 20 years. We do work with low-income homeowners, and we have done some rental preservation in the past. And then we have promote home ownership. Again, this would be for low-income households, including persons with disabilities and first-time homeowners. Thank you. Under community and neighborhood sustainability goals, we have acquisition and improvement of community facilities. An example of one we're doing right now is Community Services Northwest Wellness Center at 32nd Avenue in Maine. They're upgrading that and doing some additional work there, and we're providing funds for that along with the City of Vancouver. The second one is community infrastructure, and this would be done in the areas on the map that were green, the lower moderate income areas, and this would be infrastructure improvements, or it could be park improvements or other facilities for recreation. And then our final goal is economic vitality, creating jobs for low and moderate income people, either job creation or retention of jobs that may go away. We actually haven't done any of these yet, but we can do that by providing funds to private businesses to either create facilities or increase the size of their facilities so they would hire additional workers who would be low and moderate income.
That fund would come from where? The federal government?
That would be the Department of Housing and Development to the county as part of the CDBG program.
Increase facilities?
They're going to increase the storage facility so they can have more goods, and they need more people to work in the storage facility. Could be a warehouse. The jobs would be for low and moderate income people.
And how much money are we talking about that is usually an annual grant?
Clark County gets about $1.4 million a year. City of Vancouver gets almost exactly the same amount. And again, that's part of the HUD budget, and it's determined annually by Congress.
So it's not a formula fund?
Well, there's a formula, but HUD has to first get the total amount at the national level, which is about $3 million. And then they crank all the jurisdictions through the formula. And right now, there are about 1,250 jurisdictions that are eligible to these funds.
Is it 100% federal funds?
Yes. And then alleviation of the homelessness goals. Andy's going to talk about that, so I'll just say we're going to target families with children, unaccompanied youth, chronic homeless, and then system-wide improvements. And I'll let Andy go into the details about this, because the plan that he's updating, we will then just slide into our consultant plan. So the final thing is we are doing a community survey. This is on our website at clark.wa.gov/cdg. And we would encourage you to go in and take the survey. We're looking for your input on what we think needs to be the priorities in Clark County and things that need to be done. And we certainly encourage your input. As you can see on the website, this is also last year was the 40th anniversary of the CDG program, so it's been around quite a while. The only longer program that the county receives is the Community Services Block Grant Program, which our community action program, which is 50 years old this year.
Where are you advertising that people would give input? Just on the website?
Well, we have this on the website, but we've sent it out to all the people we deal with from the different groups. And then once we have the plan in a draft final form, we will have it available for everybody, and we'll do a newspaper advertising asking for comments, and then we'll have to have it approved by the board. The Board of County Councilors before we can submit it to HUD for their approval.
You don't need a sense that you have to link.
Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering about other people. You can get it, but just the public.
Well, Darla can send the link out to Parent Coalition.
Yeah.
But we can send out the link to people. And you can.
Otherwise, you're just hearing the same voices all the time.
And we're going around to each one of the city councils in the county and doing this for them, asking for their input, or the town council and the ACOPIS meetings, and Vancouver Housing Authority, and Coalition of Service Providers, lots of different groups to kind of tap into their input. So that's
a couple of questions related. On the slide, it's 2014 point in time, homeless subpopulations. Are any of the homeless people disabled?
Some of them are, yes.
We had, in the county plan, there's a number that we got that was homeless, and I thought it was small.
But none of them identified themselves as disabled.
Well, one of the other categories was physically disabled, and I just didn't put it on here.
Oh.
It was not as large as these numbers.
Okay.
Just to add, there are other ones that you can see. When we do that count, there are two parts to it. There's a what we call a street count, which is actually people going around trying to find people outside, and that's where the self-reporting comes in. Then there's all the numbers of people who are in emergency shelter or transitional housing or any of our programs that serve people who are homeless. So we have much more detailed information about those folks, and so I don't, of course I don't have it with me tonight, but we have the percentage of people who have a disability, and it's I mean, I just know anecdotally it's high. We have a high percentage of folks who are homeless in our homeless
community. We only have two people that are known to Developmental Disabilities Administration who were identified as homeless in their system, and it's my understanding from the supervisor that if people know about folks with developmental disabilities, that the system can do something, but I'm not sure everybody knows who to call when, and that's a huge problem.
Really, I think the number would be significantly higher.
Yeah. Well, the potential for homelessness could be quite large, the ones that might.
Would those be people that were in the DDA system?
Yes.
So there could be a lot of people with developmental disabilities
that aren't signed up.
That aren't in the DDA system.
Right.
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 Yeah, I'm just speaking in general.
But I think we may have encountered somebody who potentially could have been a customer of DDA, but I don't believe they are, and so it's a matter of helping people get connected.
Well, I know that we at the Parent Coalition end up getting calls from a lot of families who have children with disabilities that are homeless. And they struggle with shelter because if they're
fleeing a domestic violence situation, the domestic violence shelter said they couldn't take kids with developmental disabilities. And the WHO could take individuals who had domestic violence situations they were fleeing. So it kind of has put some families in a void of services.
So that's illegal. So, I mean, we should look into that. But the safe choice can't say they don't take
families. They did.
They have.
They can't legally say they didn't. So.
They right. did, and, you know, she...
I know I've met a couple of our clients, homeless, on that are in the system.
That are in the system?
Yeah. I've seen them.
Chris, about them? Yeah. Do you know them?
Yeah.
They're in the DD system, or you guys are paid?
They're in the DD system.
Okay.
There's a lot of them around the Marshall Center.
So I guess my follow-up question or comment would be, are these people, these goals, hopefully you'll have in mind not just those who are homeless or lacking an adequate shelter, those who are listed here, but those also those who are disabled?
Yes. In fact, we've done a lot of work in the past with Daryl Weaver and
Right. That is one of our concerns and goals here, is housing.
I'd like to commend your work, Pete. It's just, there's a lot of need in the community. $1.4 million sounds like a lot of money, but it's not very
much. No, it
doesn't. It's not
that much.
Well, and the one funding source we have CUG funds, and then we have what's called Home Investment Partnership funds. And at one time, you know, we get over $1 million a year in those funds. But and that was at the federal level, it was $2 billion, and then 4 years ago, Congress cut that in half, and then this last year they cut it by 10% again. So what we used to get over $1 million, now the total amount coming in between Vancouver and Clark County is about $750,000. And that money is specifically for housing construction or rehab.
You had another situation come up, Darla. Pete might know about that. The voucher.
The voucher, yeah. So we were contacted yesterday by a family who is connected to the Vancouver Housing Authority. They have a child who's a DDA client. And the other parent had stopped paying child support, and so they no longer could afford where they were living. They're trying to find another place to live, and they cannot find anybody that will take the voucher that they have. And so I don't know. I mean, I referred them back to the Housing Authority and to 211, but I felt fairly helpless in being able to give them anything where I felt hope for them.
Did you refer them to Housing Search Northwest? It's a database, but that may be tough for them to find somebody. But I can give you I'll email you tomorrow the request, the website when you have that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I think another potential resource is the Housing Authority is supposed to prioritize. 10% is it, Pete?
I'm not sure what it is now, because they're moved to work housing authority, so they've got a few different moves.
They're to prioritize people with disabilities, and once they're qualified, they never revisit the disability. So people never get the site through. Once you're in, you're in. So it's like there may be opportunities for people to thrive, get employment, seek independence, and we'll never know, because once you're in that system.
I have a question on page 4 here. I don't know your laws here and your systems, but you talk there are a number of, there's a 5%, way on the left, the bottom chart on the left, number of renters is high, the number of units is low.
But you say some of those units are being occupied by people who really shouldn't be there. Are those all private units? Can the government do anything about that, or is that just...
Well, these are based on American Community Survey, so they do a survey and they look at all the different housing units. So,
well, but what I mean is, there a way to get people who shouldn't be there out, or this is all a private thing?
It's all
private.
Yeah, you can rent whatever you want to.
Yeah.
Two parties agree.
You want to live frugally, or...
No, I understand that, but I just are these private houses, or are they houses that actually someone has some control over? No.
Well, this is a random sample of households all across the county. So you could have some people that are on Section 8, and you have a lot of people on this way who are not just private individuals.
So you really have to increase the number of government housing for those people.
No, you have to increase the number of housing for them. Yeah.
Is it the
or increase income. It's
yeah.
Other option.
Isn't the vacancy rate around 2%?
Pardon?
Isn't the vacancy rate about 2%?
Yeah, if I did some searching on the web the last couple of weeks, and it varies depending where you look between 2 to about 4.25. It depends on the data source. But it's very low, and the rents are going up very fast because
right.
of that.
Individuals who are living on their SSI are started like half of the 30% median income. I mean, very, very tiny amounts per year.
Just an editorial statement. For every homeless family or individual in the United States, there's 3 vacant homes.
Three. Even now, there's 3 vacant homes. The banks have them.
Yeah, they're in foreclosure or.
Oh. Quick question off the median income table, and maybe I'm just way out of touch. For one person, at 80%, almost $39,000 a year is considered low income?
Yes, that's
one.
That's based on the HUD CDBG program. And that 80% is legislative in the Community Development Act that was passed under President Nixon and signed by President Ford. But yes, that's how it's defined, and that's the number for this metropolitan area.
Oh.
And as you can imagine, this varies all across the country. If we were talking about Los Angeles or New York City, it would be a different number. Or if this is Fargo, North Dakota, it would be a much lower number, or New Orleans for that. Seattle's much higher than area.
But what's interesting here, this is just a percentage of the median income.
Right.
You have percentages of, I mean, what percentage of people are in each of those categories?
I don't have it with me, but I did show the number of homeowners and renters in the slides.
No, I just mean the people. What number of people are...
In Clark County, the total number of people who are about 40, it's about 40% of the population is less than 80%. And that's countywide.
Retire from before they can pay cash and have giant homes.
There was a woman, she worked with her contract, she's a wife of one of her contractors. And she said that's what she does, and she said people come and pay cash.
Yeah.
$450,000 homes in cash to retire people. So they're all from California.
Well, knowing what my son paid for his house, they're Palo Alto, a lot of them.
Nationwide, about 25% of home sales are cash only.
25%?
Nationwide. Hot spot is Miami.
Yeah.
Can I have some kind of out-of-state tax for people moving in and buying?
Now you sound like Tom McCall.
That's where I got my idea.
Yeah. So, Andy, do you want to talk about the consolidated homeless plan?
Sure.
You're not doing a PowerPoint yet.
No. I like to come to meetings unprepared as possible. Good evening. My name is Andy Silver. I'm the executive director for the Council for the Homeless. And this was actually really good timing to have Pete go and then meet Tom, because now that you have that picture of sort of the affordable housing crisis in our community, we can talk about sort of one end of that spectrum, which is homelessness. As Pete mentioned, back in 2006, our county had our first 10-year homeless plan. It was part of a statewide effort, and that's been updated several times. It's a quite a lengthy, involved document, the current version. I think with all the attachments, it's 150 pages. It's got lots and lots of different strategies. We are in the process of we're working with Pete's unit to do the community engagement and draft and a kind of a reset to the plan. It's going to look very different. We're trying to create sort of more a short-term action plan set up. It'll be much shorter, somewhere in the 4 or 5 page range. We're focusing on, as Pete mentioned, sort of maintaining the system that we have, doing some system-wide improvements, especially around access and accountability around outcomes. And then we're also looking to try to bring in additional resources in 3 different subpopulations. Not just bring in more resources, but focus more attention. And the idea is that, if we could do it all at once, we would. But this is sort of, let's do this first, and then we can build on it. And those 3 areas are families with children, unaccompanied youth, and chronic homelessness. Families with children, as we kind of mentioned earlier, is defined as either having children in the household who are under 18 or an adult who is dependent. Unaccompanied youth in our system means sort of 25 or younger and not part of some family unit. So it could be as young as 12 or 13, but just means they're on their own. And chronic homelessness, there's a very technical definition that we work under, that somebody has to have been homeless for a year or more, or 4 times in the last 3 years, so sort of cycling, and they have to have a disability. So the thought process, there was a lot of kind of community engagement around picking those 3 areas to focus on first, and some of it's driven by funding, which always happens, but a lot of it was driven by kind of the chronic homelessness category is one of those you hear in a lot of different systems. It's the 10-50 issue, 10% of the people using 50% of resources. So the idea is that if we can serve them better and get them stable, it'll free up resources such as emergency shelter that we don't have enough capacity for other populations. And unaccompanied youth and families with children, the idea is really about sort of supporting our youth so that we're not just having this cycle over and over again. We know from our work that one of the leading indicators of risk of homelessness is things that happen to you as a child, such as experiencing homelessness or other sorts of trauma. So I could talk more about the details of what we're thinking right now, but it would really be helpful for me to get a little input from you, if possible, around... I read, I forget what it's called, but the latest version of your plan.
Would you like a coffee?
I would love a copy. I just have it online.
Oh, it just so happens to
have. And I did a quick find the word housing and saw the different places that housing was in there. And one of the things, thank you very much. One of the things I want to talk about, we have some initiatives going on to try to address this broader affordable housing crisis. Because the underlying issue across the board with all of our populations, as Pete went through in detail, is that we don't have nearly the housing stock or incomes we need in the community. And because of that, we have huge access problems. So, you know, we heard the story about somebody who even has a Section 8 voucher and can't find an apartment. In our system, that's even worse. For the families that we're connecting to programs that help pay their rent, we only have a 50% rate of actually finding a landlord who will take that family. So somebody comes to us, they're living in their car, hopefully we can get them in a shelter. They wait for months and months and months for an opening of someone who has a program who can try to get them back into housing. They get in that opening, and there's only a 50% chance we can find the landlord in the community who's willing to rent to them. So this is a massive problem that we have. And for our tiny system that we're looking at people who are living in their cars and those sorts of situations, there are many, many, many times as many people who are doubled up with friends or family or couch surfing. And that's all still before you get to the population Pete was going over of that rent burden category, right? So we have, in the homelessness world, I think it's as bad as we've ever seen it in terms of the strain on our system because of this crisis across the board. So we're working on a number of levels on that. We have partnership with Clark County, City of Vancouver, the Housing Authority, and the Community Foundation of Southwest Washington to actually create, hopefully with community buy-in, an affordable housing plan for our community, which we've never really had before, a vision of how we're going to get from where we are today to the 20,000 unit gap of affordable housing that we have, and starting to look at what the law changes would need to be, et cetera. So that sort of work is happening, but in the meantime, we have folks who are currently homeless. And one of the things we're looking at is, what are the issues that are separate from the capacity problem? Because unfortunately, we're not going to solve the capacity problem today. So a lot of it's driven by capacity. You know, so if the problem is somebody called for shelter and there's no shelter available, that's a capacity problem. If they're waiting for a long time for the housing resource. But we know there are other issues too. There are access issues. So for example, in the chronically homeless community, there are a lot of trust issues, and people might not even aren't going to come to us for help, and we don't have a lot of outreach capacity to go to them. So that's something that we have to fix in addition to capacity. I'm guessing that this population might be a population where we have access issues. For example, I didn't know that there are specific, now hopefully my staff does, but I didn't know that there are specific housing resources that are available maybe to somebody who's in the...
I don't know that the housing resource exists, but there are people that can put energy to it.
Okay.
They are connected with the state,
okay,
NDA. If they're not connected, and perhaps should be, because there's a big gap between who the system knows,
yeah,
and who's out there, like Mike was saying, and since it's a voluntary system, you have to go to it and,
yeah,
ask for it. It's not an entitlement, and it's not going to necessarily come. I think the last time that they had outreach was in 1982, and it was behind my file cabinet when I worked for the state. And that was the last time the state was able to do outreach.
But if we had a better
you need a connection with,
yeah,
the case. And so I talked to the state supervisor, Darren Stengel. I talked to Home Community Services
supervisor of case managers, and I talked to the RSN and asked them if they would do training for your case managers, and they were all willing to do that. But I haven't had a chance to talk to
them. Okay. Okay, perfect. So that's the type of thing, and I'll put that right, we can put that right in the plan that we're going to create better access. I mean, if we just have a connection between our access point and
a good phone, a good Rolodex goes a long way. Being able to call somebody when you know that, or help them,
right,
the person get to one.
Yeah, right. So other than that, are there other, that you already know about, are there other sort of access issues that overlap with the homelessness system that we need to be aware of working on our plan or just in general?
Well, who wants to go first? I can say one little thing that I think Darla wants to say something. I think Mike wants to say something. I bet you want to say something. So I think we have a lot of people who want to move out and not live with their families. And that's a good thing, because if they live with their families, eventually they'll be homeless because their families will no longer be able to provide care. And they need a roommate, which is why we've been talking about roommate matching. Because they, just in general, lots of young people have roommates. And so that would make it a little more affordable. But they have no way to meet each other at this point. There's not a good place. I mean, people don't go to bars to meet, and that's not.
Unless it's exciting about the art,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
If that's when I worked for the store, one of the things that we looked at was it wasn't even such a matter of capacity. You have an aging out population looking at the demographics. So a lot of single heads, of, you know, single parents, where a parent has died, and they live in these large houses, and they need to help maintaining the property. And you could get a young couple or other people if you could find a way to match those individuals up. You could find a lot of, it wasn't for a lack of capacity so much as it was matching people and getting people in the right situation that was mutually beneficial. And that would be a really affordable way of getting people into housing.
That's something that the Commission on Aging is discussing quite a bit about.
Yeah.
As they're looking at some of the demographics that they're working with or concerned about, they're seeing such exactly the same thing you're talking about, Michael, is, you know, how can the person stay in their home with maybe the principal generator of income being gone, and or just keeping things up, you know,
right,
as they get older.
And then if you have a single mother with a couple of kids that can move in and help out and maintain the residence.
Yeah. Mutually help each other.
Yeah.
We talked about in terms of disabled people, right? Why do we always have to see about what can we do for disabled people? There's a lot of disabled people who can do things for,
right,
for other people and get that match.
As long as the communication is clear, because that is such a huge piece. It could be, yeah, I want to do this. And then they get in there, and it's not a good match.
Well,
because somebody gets a little too bossy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's any moment.
Yeah.
I think it could be designed. I think you could.
And they're good models.
It should be tried.
Oh, I
think,
agree.
So Ecumenical Ministries and Portland had a long, unfortunately, they got defunded, but up until a year ago, they had a program that was very successful, and they got all the forms and stuff. And there's also a national shared housing organization that provides technical assistance.
What was the name of the place in Portland?
I have the hardest time saying it. Thank you.
Ecumenical.
The problem is here. Excuse me.
Go ahead.
The problem is, yeah, even your the government things are, it's all siloed, right?
Right.
So you really have to have someone who've got a foot in both, you know, a system, people who are put there, because otherwise even parents, they come and they don't know who to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get someone, not just have someone put those things together, but then have someone who can interface with the public as well, and to help them. A lot of people, you know, we have college educations and stuff, but for us, a lot of paperwork is hard and some things are. Can you imagine some people who don't have the language or don't have anything, so it really is necessary to have those kind of brokers, people, whatever, the interface. right. Not just to connect the agencies, but then to connect that information out. Right. And who's going to pay for those? Because silos get paid for it. Those other people don't.
Well, and that's the right. That's a big difficulty. And from the homelessness plan, we talk about affordable housing. It's a lot broader. But from the homelessness systems, it's not going to pay for something like that because we can't even pay for all the people who are already outside. So it doesn't allow us to go that far upstream. The hope with having this broader affordable housing conversation is how do we finance these things, and how do we have a comprehensive view of this so it's not, so we don't, and I don't mean, I think the shared housing thing is great, but right, is there a better, do we need each silo to have their own shared housing program, or can we do something together?
Well, yeah, I think that you can do things together. We probably don't need to have a lot of people matching people, but we do need something for people who don't know how, who have barriers to meeting each other and social difficulty anyway.
Sure.
So that makes it a double whammy because they can't go down to the local way and meet somebody and say, oh, let's put them in. You know, or they might, and that's a really bad idea.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that the Services Council has proposed, it's pretty safe to say that C-Trans can support is a model that you may want to consider. It's a one-click call center to find transportation options that not only include C-Tran as a public transportation provider, but also other providers and volunteers, so that anybody, depending upon what their need is, can go to one website or make one call, and they not only get referred to what maybe that call center taker's institution is, let's say it's Medicaid transportation or it's C-Tran or C-Van or whatever, but it gives them an opportunity to see what other alternatives are also out there. And it's called mobility management. It's becoming a growing field within public transportation or transportation in general. The same philosophy, the one-click reference or the one-call reference, I think can be also translated to homelessness or to affordable housing. My first initial thoughts is that something that should be done by the Vancouver Housing Authority. I mean, that's in part some of the mission of which they provide services. And most people, if you said, okay, if you're homeless, who should you call? If you said, well, you should call the Vancouver Housing Authority, that's going to, for me at least, that's a connection that makes more sense than, oh, you should call the ARC, or you should call XYZ, or you should call this. And by having it being one centralized contact point, whether or not it's 211, 911 is the best example, 711 or 511 or whatever it is, my point of it is that part of what the issue is with homelessness is that people don't always know what the resources are, and so as a consequence can't make that decision.
So the good news is we actually did do that.
Good.
I should have said that. So in March of 2013, we opened the Housing Solutions Center, which is run by the Council for the Homeless. And so it used to be that we had it unified just for emergency shelter, and now it's emergency shelter, homelessness prevention, and the housing programs that are for people who are homeless. Now there's the whole, that's not all of affordable housing, which is a much bigger arena and needs that sort of same coordination. So in some ways that's great. Of course, the problem is there's still not nearly enough help. So what often, it's called coordinated assessment. What often happens is it's just a quicker no or a quicker we can get you on this waiting list. But at least they get that once rather than 12 different times.
What's that called? The Housing Solution?
Housing Solution Center. And the housing hotline, which is the phone number, is 360-695-9677. The connection, which makes so much sense to the community between affordable housing and homelessness, doesn't exist in the provider landscape. And unfortunately, what in our system is called prevention, homelessness prevention. So that's if somebody is doubled up or couch surfing, they fall into that category. There's generally for our entire community, every week, somewhere between zero and two or three openings to help people in that situation. And any given week, there are about 200 people calling for that sort of help. And the reason for that is the affordable housing crisis, right? So what we're trying to do from the homelessness perspective is reshift what we consider to be prevention from sort of a one-time paying somebody's back rent, which is great, but if you're only doing it for one out of every 200, how effective sort of is that? To working more in the policy arena, advocacy arena, and saying, you know, wouldn't our time be better spent advocating for $200 million investment in the Housing Trust Fund at the state level so we can actually build more affordable housing so less people are calling us for help. So in our plan, we're trying to make our services for people who are literally homeless better and trying to identify those policy and those sort of changes in this affordable housing plan in order to try to make less demand on the system and less need in the first place.
Are the units that Vancouver Housing Authority is building out on East First Street, are those going to be helping at all as affordable housing?
Yes and no. I mean, any helps, but it's kind of a drop in the bucket. At this point, anything is a drop in the bucket in the overall sort of community need. Just because, I mean, problem of the day, I don't know if you guys have heard, there's this building called Courtyard Village. It's been in the papers. It's in Rose Village. It's just across the street. And it's not subsidized. It's not a housing authority property. But it traditionally had an owner who, the downside was they never fixed it up. It was a terrible place to live, but they also didn't raise the rents. And it was a place that would take folks that we helped. And 151 units across several buildings. They sold the building, the new building, the owner is going to fix it up, is basically kicking everybody out as they do it. So just in that one thing, we're losing 151 units, and it's the tip of the iceberg. We're getting calls all the time about buildings where they're slapping a coat of paint on and raising the rent $150 a month. So we need to keep building, but we need to identify other, you know, whether it's anywhere from zoning changes to ways that we can incentivize more tax breaks, financing mechanisms, more private partnerships. We just need that. We need to get out of the sort of one or two buildings a year, or we're just going to keep going downhill.
Is there this idea of reaching out to people who are overhoused right now? Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's ever been any kind of effort to do that. And there are a lot of single older people living in homes that have three or four homes that could use help and assistance if you could find the right individuals to support. I mean, I think there's a huge capacity that's already built. It's just sitting there right now.
We try to do that on a very, very tiny, small level. It could be done obviously a lot bigger. And the problems that we run into in our population is that the same reasons the property management companies don't want to rent to our folks are the reasons that the person doesn't want somebody living in their home, right? So the easiest one is bad credit. Everyone who's homeless has bad credit because that's how they got, you know, that's stuff happened. But then most of our folks have past evictions, they have, they might have past felonies, they might have behavioral health issues, and what we find is we get that phone call of, we have that $400 apartment and we want someone who's between 25 and whatever and not a smoker and da 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 da, and then we never find anybody to put there. So I think on a community level, it would, you know, not just for the homelessness issue, but part of this broader thing, there's probably a way there to take some of the strain off. But when we try to do it sort of with our population, it doesn't work that well.
What about, we have a few, not a lot, but a few successful home ownership because the National Home of Your Own Project, we were excited about that some years back. And that we did get some banks to do all that, and we got people to own their own places, which I think probably works a little better with a condo than it does for a house, unless the family's willing to help keep up the yard and things. But is there any support in the plan to help people own something?
In the broader affordable housing one, yes. Uh-huh. And I think one of the things that needs to be tackled is, so one of the ways to make it a comprehensive plan is to line up all those different strategies from home ownership included and the different needs and making sure that we're matching them so that we, like home ownership is not going to be a good solution for everybody, but it's going to be a good solution for some people. And how are we, again, getting back to this getting out of our silos and a community-wide effort, figuring out how much, not just how much home ownership we need to meet that need, but then how do we connect those people so that we don't end up with this overhousing and underhousing and that sort of thing. And I honestly don't know, I am not by any means an expert in affordable housing. I have a board member, luckily, who has a long background in affordable housing and has agreed to sort of be a technical expert at the community on this effort, but it's going to be a big learning curve for me and a lot of people, I think, as we there are a lot of different strategies out there, and there are a lot of different strategies that have failed in other communities. So we can't just, we got to look at not only what's out there, what's worked in places similar to our community, what's politically feasible, and how are we going to finance it, which is always the fun part.
I think I might, my husband and I really might be in the minority to have a rental in all we've ever cared about. Like, not in the minority to have a rental, lots of people have rentals, but all we've ever cared about is that the rent is paid and that the person in there doesn't trash it, right? So for 7 years, we've rented to the same people, never raised the rent. Now the mom is a single mom with, you know, 3 kids. She barely makes that bill because I get the garbage bill and the utility bill, you know, paid by X date, or this is your final notice for shop. And she always gets that paid, but she has to let other bills kind of slide. But she always pays her rent. And so we've just left it the same price for 7 years. And we've owned the house a long time. And it covers the mortgage and gives us extra. You know, you can save that for repairs that come up now and again. But it's just, you know, can you find other good people like that that would just be willing to help, you know, as long as the rent is paid, the place isn't trashed.
Yeah.
And I guess it would be more comfortable, not in time in the near future, because I don't see this family going anywhere. They've been there for 7 years, and like I said, a single mom. But, you know, maybe at some date down the road, I would be game if I knew that there would be some support where the people weren't going to, you know, abuse it.
Yeah.
And maybe you might find other landlords that would be in the same frame of mind. I don't know. I don't know that every single one is like, hike the rent and we'll make more money off this place.
Yeah. Yeah. The guy at my church that's doing what you do.
Yeah.
And he's not, they aren't making his rent right now. He's just hanging in there with it.
Yeah, and we have a there'll be a big focus on the system-wide part of the plan on landlord incentives. So we've and this is a new thing that we've been piloting with Pete's department of making sure that at least that it's financially equivalent if you rent to our. And what I mean by that is we can pay higher security deposits. We could, if something happens and there is damage to the apartment, something doesn't go right, we can reimburse up to a certain level. But if we find those folks who are willing to give people a second chance, enticing, you know, making it a little, at least an equal financial footing for them. And then the other thing that I think is really interesting with that is that we've heard a little bit that there are some people who might be interested in doing that and sort of having one or two rentals, and that there are some sort of laws that are unintentionally holding them back in terms of you know, doesn't quite meet this code or that permitting process. And maybe that's the thing that we can look at with the jurisdictions is, you know, can we make it a little bit easier for people? If people are willing to step up and help solve this problem, can we make it easier for them to do it and take some of those barriers down?
So when you get that, I think it's important to get some of that figured out. It's important to get back to us because we have a big network that we can get out to.
Sure.
And not everybody is, I mean, there are people in the disability world whose families own rentals,
yeah.
own businesses.
That would be great.
Is it all the Cooney Foundation?
Yes, yeah, we got that too.
Right. So I will follow up with you also
yeah.
about the connection yeah. with the current, and then I'll stay in touch as we're developing these plans, and hopefully we can.
My number is in the touch on any plan, and then we probably should talk about the who I need to talk to.
Sure.
And I just want to, before you go, I just want to say that the divorce rate among families who have children with developmental disability is up in the 90s. It's very high. Oftentimes, a parent cannot find child care that the child does not continually get kicked out of. Therefore, that single parent being able to go to work and being able to come up with funding for anything is next to impossible. And we have many families that do just live in cars because they couldn't live, they couldn't go to the shelter and survive. They couldn't do a lot of the stuff that other people that are homeless can do. You know, when you have children, especially the children that are tend to have more behavioral issues and struggle with communication and stuff, you know, they do have issues in causing some damage to the properties where they're living and things like that. And so there's a whole variety, and I think there's this hidden community of people that are homeless that we're not seeing and that are not getting counted.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And please do, so the way the system is supposed to work with the WHO, so the WHO is, if anyone doesn't know, is the overflow shelter, and then there are year-round shelters. And in the winter, the system is people go to the WHO first, and then as openings go, they go to the other shelters. I'm talking about the way it's supposed to work. The exception to that is that there's some people who can't go to the WHO because maybe a disability or maybe various reasons, and they are supposed to go directly to the year-round shelters. If there are problems with that, please, please, please call me. My former job was suing people about disability rights violations in homeless shelters and housing programs, so I'm very sensitive to this issue. So please do follow up. Yeah.
Well, this is. I just think that if we provide some training for you all, then it will be a little smoother with the volunteers who are there because they're really good people stepping up every week. And they look to the share volunteers as the experts.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you all for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, just ask.
The next agenda item is the legislative update, and so right now board members are meeting with our legislators in meetings around town, so, and I know some have happened and some are scheduled to happen in the next few days, so how...
Mary and I and Darla met with Brandon Vick today and talked about the budget that nobody's happy with that the governor put out, and emphasize that, you know, the transition dollars are just a real key. And I use your analogy of, you know, you can have a 30-year mortgage and you get to 20-year, 29, and then you give up, and, you know, that's what transitions that 30th year is to get them over that hump.
and he gets it. And he was asking some pretty good questions. Yesterday we got stood up, so I have one more next tomorrow.
Jim Muller,
yeah,
was a no-show, but we'll have to call. But Walt, you and Del?
Yeah, Del and I and Larry have been on the road quite a bit. We met with Representative Rivers, Wilson, and Harris. Wilson being the newest elected official out in the East County area. Appeared to be very open to understanding what the requests are, very close to the vest as far as, you know, what kind of promises or commitment, but seemed to be genuinely interested, seemed to focus in on a lot of what Dell's story is, and again, being a small business owner or a medium-sized business owner, the same with Representative Harris, is that there's this connection with employment that seems to be positive. I think they, all three, gave me the impression that they're very supportive of transition and very supportive of that. Representative Harris, his track record so far has been very supportive of what our needs are, seemed to be encouraged. There didn't seem to be a concern about the cuts that the governor's budget is indicating. But the proof is in the pudding. I mean, it's easy for them in a local Starbucks jacked up on caffeine to do the head nod. The reality is in June or July when we see what they actually did.
There was one comment made by someone, I don't think it's necessary to mention the person's name, but that I thought was quite interesting, Mary, you were there. When this person said, we were talking about transition and this whole idea of you put all this money into them in the education system, you get them up to the 21 years old, and then you just gotta leave them out, put them out to pasture. And this person said, so we're talking about, it does cost money. And this person said something about, but after a while, you get to the point where they don't need help anymore. And I don't think they understand disability.
Mm-hmm. We explained that the amount that people need when they've been on a job a long time diminishes over time. But if they were to go away completely, it would be a square one. They'd go to the ER.
Reminds me, you went to a village in Vietnam, you know, we brought some Hanoi expert to come out there, and all these people brought their kids out, and the expert came out and they said, well, are you going to cure them all? Doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Doesn't work like that. It's incredible that, yeah. I heard on the news today that they had a poll of, they want to raise three taxes in Washington, and that between 55 and 63% of the people said that was okay. So maybe we'll look at some money.
We've heard both in our travels. Mm-hmm. So, and from both sides.
I just want to add one other thing, is that they all knew Darla. I think some are feared, are very anxious, but they all know her. I was really amazed, and I always have been, what a strong advocate you are, and I appreciate that quite a bit.
I appreciate being allowed to tag along to you.
Oh, yeah, it's great. It really gives some insight.
She's dangerous.
Yes, she is. A couple of the folks.
Stay that way.
Don't want to tick her off.
They know she'll come knocking on the office door.
She just doesn't go away.
When she said, we'll see you every week.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
on the agenda was a letter for the Hopkinson School District. So I bet many of you may have seen this, but on Monday, December 8th in the Columbian, there was an article about Hopkinson School seeking a $40 million bond. And the article goes on to say that it needs to, you know, replace a Hopkinson Middle School because the middle school is now more than 60 years old. I quote it. I gotta read this because it's just the way this was written. Now more than 60 years old, the school is in desperate need of modernization, district officials say. The campus no longer complies with a number of safety standards and accessibility codes. The next paragraph goes on to talk about how the student population has outgrown the school and that there's portables, blah, blah, blah. The new campus would be built to accommodate 600 students. It would also sit next to the current school on the north side of the existing track and field. And the old building would still be used for the school's special education program. So, if I could say, Kay Park, ever the astute watchdog, saw that and was all over it to the Hopkinson School Board. How could you deem this school, that no longer complies with a number of safety standards and accessibility codes, not good enough for the general student population, but A-okay for the specialized students? So she wrote the school board a letter and has been in contact with them about the issue. So we wanted to, as a board, chime in on the issue as well. And my intent was to have an action item for the board tonight. My intent was to have a draft letter to be approved. But then, you know, holidays and illness and things got in the way. I don't have a draft tonight for you. But
I'll send out a draft because we're working on it.
We don't have to wait for another month. We can do that by email, can't we?
Can we approve the action to send a letter and then
we've done that.
You can do that, yes. You can approve the sending a letter. Yes.
We can have take action. We can have an executive, a little committee help you as far as that goes.
Sure.
Write it and then we just
need a motion to
write a letter to discuss this issue with the Hopkinson School Board, citing that we're a little concerned that if it's not good enough for their general population, why would it be for the special ed?
You did a favor.
What's that?
Into the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Right. Yeah, they didn't pick up on that.
You know,
I second that.
We should suggest they set all the special education in the whole county there.
It's such a great place.
Yeah.
And so,
should we write the board first before we put it into an open thing? I don't know. What's the protocol?
Well, Kay did get a response.
Oh.
And he says, oops. So I think you need to look at, I can't remember it right now because.
I think it was oops.
I mean, we could write something like, you know, we are confident that this is not your intent.
Right.
It's certainly going to come across as a healthy choice.
Is there seconds to Mary's
motion?
10 seconds.
Okay. Any further discussion?
I think it is a good point that perhaps at the outset it maybe should be sent just to the board. And
I would add to the same motion that we approve you getting help from one or two community members to write the letter.
Sounds like
Ted's
looking for a job.
Who do you see on a regular basis? You see Mary, don't you?
No, she's in this building.
But we I sent her a draft.
But
somebody else can.
If you want to send me, you can look outside. I'll
yeah?
Look
okay.
I agree with all the time. I'll put 80% in my
hands. All right.
Mary, is the money for K-12 still allocated differently? Do you have, based on the number of special ed students?
The money for special ed, you know, there's the assumption that it's special ed student is costing a basic ed allocation plus a more, and so I think it's still allocated by 12%. You know, they changed that.
Oh, 12.8%.
Yeah, something like that. And but the basic ed allocation is also to be used for the special ed students, what they would typically spend on a student.
The point of order, let's finish the motion and let's.
Yeah. Well,
call for the question.
If there's any more, if there's no further discussion, then we vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? So the motion passes. Okay. Vote. Write the letter. Send the letter to Darling.
Okay. Let's talk about the governor's budget.
Smiley faces. Actually, I will say there are more smiley faces than I anticipated. This is the Book 2 budget. There was a Book 1 because, constitutionally speaking, our governor has to put out a balanced budget assuming no new revenue and that equals out. They said it was so extreme that they didn't release it out to the public. It is available on OFM's website. So what they released to the public the week of December the 18th was the Book 2 budget. There are some things in it that are okay. We'll just go down from the top. The first thing, supported living right now is having a huge, as SEIU, the Union for the Independent Providers, has been very successful in negotiating with our legislature to raise the rates for independent providers. The supported living providers have not had that same parity in rate raises. So due to that fact, supported living providers are working at a little bit above minimum wage, some at minimum wage, and they're currently at about a 50% turnover rate in supported living, which causes issues from individuals' employment, individuals' behaviors, training people to follow the plans that individuals need is a huge problem. The governor did put in 50 cent an hour raise. That's about a quarter of what the supported living providers are asking for. But that is in there, and 50 cents is better than nothing, so we got a smiley face, but we need more.
You know, the Affordable Care Act medical coverage isn't just a residential issue.
I know. But because it's the residential people who have been going and advocating for that, that's the funding to help, starting January of 2016, cover that affordable care implementation for the residential providers. And my understanding, and I'm not a residential expert at all, but my understanding is that with the supported living providers, there is a admin budget and there is a direct care budget. And this is the direct care budget that we're talking about, not the admin budget. Last year when Andy Hill did his bill and we got the new funding for the individual and family services slots and we got the new waiver slots, if you look down to the third bullet down, they're looking to take away 500 of the 1,000 basic waiver slots that we got. Those basic waiver slots are the slots that would go toward transition students, families in crisis, individuals in crisis that was needing something immediately. This is federal and state dollar combined. So that is huge. Cutting it back to 500 is not enough. We've been working really hard to try and swoop up anybody here in Clark County that hasn't had got their transition student connected yet and at least get them connected. But we're having a really hard time finding anybody.
You used to give us this more or less than last year. Do you have some numbers here?
What happens is we will, so this is the governor's budget. Once the House budget comes out, then that's when the comparison comes in.
Well, it wasn't from previous years.
I can get that and give it to you. Well, but this is increase or decrease from last year's budget.
All right.
This is a reduced from last
year. Yeah, so this is reduced from last year's. Or where you see the smiley faces is the increase from last year's.
Yeah, but is it 10% increase, 1%,
you know? Well, what they're, I'll get you that information. Okay. I'm sorry I didn't bring it.
No, don't worry.
Fourth bullet down are, again, the individual and family services slot. Because of the community first choice option and the move to put individual and family services into a waiver, we were going to add 4,000 new waiver slots and then an additional 1,000 new waiver slots for a total of 5,000. Governor's budget cuts that back from the 4,000 to the 2,000. He does not address the 1,000 that's because of individual and family services going to a waiver. Enhanced respite for community crisis stabilization. You know, that sounds really good, and we got a smiley face. I was very frustrated listening to central office on Monday talk about that's 2 beds statewide, and those must be really nice mattresses.
This much is two
beds.
Oh my goodness.
Now that's for the community crisis stabilization. I don't know how much of that goes into enhanced respite. Chris, do you know?
I don't.
Okay, I don't hear. Sorry, I'll try to keep opinions up. there's an increase to adult family home rates. And create a 5-year program for meaningful home-based activities. We really want to try to get people out in the community versus home-based activities. But and some of that went into the DDA budget. Some of that actually went into ATSA's budget, not DDA's budget. Individual provider rate increase, wages, health care, training, personal time, and retirement. That was a negotiation with the SEIU union, I believe. Agency providers, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, they took a decrease in rates, and so this just gives them back what they took away a couple years ago. And then agency provider rate increased for parity with individual providers. I don't understand, and Chris, I hope you do, the difference between that and the number, the first bullet with the increase, the 50 cents an hour increase.
Well, agency provider,
it's a parity though, so it's to give additional equality.
Which they're saying agency provider, which help with supportive.
Oh no, they're agency providers for individual versus individual providers. So the difference is that supported living is 24-hour care, I think. I mean, I know that, but and then an agency provider might be if I chose to hire somebody to come into my home and help me with one of my children, and I worked through an agency to get that provider to come in, like CDM. Or I hired an individual provider that was not with an agency to come in. So that's to put parity there. So that's where that confusion
and
is.
And this probably also was in the ATSA budget.
There's money to go into the rehabilitation centers. There was some PASAR, which I can tell you what they are. I don't know what PASAR stands for.
It's PASAR. SSR is free
authorization
admission
service.
Screening.
Okay. Oh, screening.
Yeah, there's a screen and there's some.
For services of rehabilitation?
Screening. That's what it is,
Pre-admission screening, whatever. So the documentation for individuals in the institutions that were not documented and screened appropriately before going either into a nursing home or having a placement done. And so we had some findings from CMS, so we needed to go in. What Evelyn, the head of DDA, said on Monday was that all the PASAR issues have been corrected at this point in time, but we need to go ahead and put additional funding into the RHCs to come up to compliance with what CMS is requesting.
Google knows what it is. It's pre-admission screening resident review.
Resident review. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Is that because Lakeland had
findings? Lakeland had the findings, but they corrected it around the state.
Oh.
The four institutions, not just at Lakeland. And then our big fat smiley face, they gave us no transition dollars. And they took away our state-only employment dollars. That's 12 individuals here in Clark County. It's about 400 statewide. That we met with the policy person, one of the policy individuals from the governor's office on Monday, and said, why did the governor do this? Because this is a governor who clearly supports employment first. So we don't understand why they did this. And so there wasn't a lot of answers, but we're continuing to ask the questions. We're going to advocate and fight to get that back. And as all of you have met with your legislators, that's been your primary message this week.
What kind of numbers did they take away?
We figured for the transition students, it's about $3.5 million per biennium, about
1.2, 1.7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't your fund come out this
Yes,
that's the
money. So I would love for you to come to Olympia with me and bring your family on multiple occasions.
Or at least one.
At least one, yes. And then
you can bring a flag too.
Yeah.
Over
the flag. Funding for early intervention services was in the governor's budget. That also is being addressed through the McCleary decision. And so that is there. The McCleary decision will, which, if you remember, that's the lawsuit where the districts went after the state for not fully funding education. As basic education allotments go up, special education allotments go up as well. It's a Christenage, thank you. And so one of the things we're looking at is to make sure that those funding from the McCleary, if it's going into the schools, is supporting all of the children appropriate. So that's where we're at. We haven't heard, as someone said, not a lot of support for this budget. The House will come out with their budget next. It's up to them to create the budget first. And we are in a long session this time because it is the big two-year session, budget session. And then the Senate will come out last.
He pretty much said, when Brandon say today, he said it was in the recycle bin on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah.
So we don't know what it's going to happen exactly. Yeah.
Does the House have a date that they're trying to get their budget out on?
Probably, but it hasn't. They haven't shared.
Yes.
We're still struggling to get committee lists at this point in time. Not that committees have been decided. They haven't publicized them all yet. We've gotten some, but not complete lists. So we need to. I know there has been a lot of shifts in the committees that the legislators are on, and so really looking at who's where and who can we target for different, which legislators can we go to ask for different needs.
What does it cost to rent a bus to go to Olympia from here? We should take all the students from our transition center. Maybe I could raise some money for paper.
A 12-passenger van is about $217.
Oh, my gosh.
But there will be 12 passenger vans going up, multiple on days.
We should talk to the transition folks to get all the kids on. You get back between 8, you could leave at 8.
We leave at 8, we're back by 5. We could be back earlier if we needed to be. It would be a great field trip, very educational. Any other questions on budgets before we go forward? We've heard everything from the sky is falling, to, oh, it's not nearly as bad. We don't know why they're saying the sky is falling. It actually looks pretty good. So it'll be interesting.
It's anybody's guess. Yeah.
So.
Thank you.
Medicaid. And so much is happening. I struggle to know where to start. But one of the things that I feel is most timely and most important is we have a transition plan. So So the Center for Medicaid Services put forth some new definitions around what a qualified setting environment is to spend Medicaid dollars on. And then once that goes forward, which as soon as the next state level agency made a change with CMS, the clock started ticking and we had so long to make a transition plan to transition all of our community settings to meet those new definitions. So I think it was aging for mental health. It wasn't us, it wasn't DD, but somebody else put forth some plan in October, did a change in October, made the clock start ticking, so we had to come up with a transition plan for the state. The transition plan is now available, and it's 100 and some very interesting pages to read, 108 now, because they changed it on yesterday. They edited it on yesterday. But so I tried to come up with just a synopsis. What I handed out to you is the just Evelyn Perez sent this to us, and it just says, this is what it is, this is when we're submitting it. We're looking for, they have pushed back public comment period to February 6th because they made changes to it yesterday. And any comments that, any public comments that are made now where you go in and you look and you read and you make these comments will be visible to CMS now. So we were actually encouraging everybody to wait until after the webinar, I think it was December the 17th, so that CMS could see all of those comments. So just going through the residential settings, the settings that fully comply with the home and community-based services characteristics are in-home supports, supported living, adult day services, group home, licensed staff residential, child foster care, group care facilities, assisted living facilities, DDA individual employment work sites, DDA group supported employment work sites, community health care providers, dental providers, vehicle modification providers, veterinarians for service animals, and transportation providers. With certain changes, these are the settings that need to be changed. Some of the adult family homes, adult residential care, DDA group training homes, DDA companion homes, and Prevoke. So, and I will forward this to Mary so she can send it all out to you. I wanted to do some...
Why does adult day health...
Adult day health and adult residential services are pretty easy. It has to do with locks on the doors. People cannot be locked in, so against their will, unless there is a certain plan and procedure that DDA has to approve. So for some people who happen to be wanderers or runners, you know, they, for their own safety, might need different precautions, and there's a process they can go through. But generically speaking, you can't lock somebody in. So those are pretty minor changes. Once they make those changes, then...
sooner or later, it wasn't happening.
No. Then those settings will qualify under CMS's rules.
Okay.
So that's adult family home and the adult residential services. The DDA group training, which is a training home...
Do we have any of those? Not here.
I don't think we do either. I'm always really confused on that.
Region 6.
Region 6.
ICFMR free zone.
Are those considered ICFMRs?
Well, there's a lesser designation, I think.
Well,
what is? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an ICFMR, but it was at a different, it wasn't the same as our RHC, but it was considered an ICFMR, and it is a free zone.
So an ICFMR is an immediate care facility for the mentally retarded.
Yeah. And so they don't say that anymore because you don't use that language anymore, and I don't know what they call it anymore. But
it just replaced the MR with
ID. ICF ID?
IDF ID?
No, just intellectual disability ID.
Okay.
Yeah, so I get eligibility category.
There you go. So what those settings, which we don't have any here, would have to do is change the lockable entrance doors with units would have to have lockable entrance doors with appropriate staff having keys to the doors. The unit or room would be a specific physical place that can be owned, rented, or occupied under another legal enforceable agreement by the individual receiving services, and the individual has, at a minimum, the same responsibility and protections from evictions the tenants have under the landlord-tenant law of the state, county, city, or other designated entity. So the difference really there is to protect individuals from not being able to be kicked out. And then basically the same is true with our companion homes. So with the companion home setting, and there's 68 of these now in the state. I'm always interested to watch that number. But there's 68 of these. They have to be able to lock their bedroom door to lock people out if they want of their room. They need to be able to have a physical safe place and, again, have all those same protections from evictions that you would have otherwise. If these changes are put into place, then those settings will also comply under the Center for Medicaid Services definitions for appropriate settings. That takes us up to DDA's pre-voc settings. And they have determined that the pre-voc settings do not meet the characteristics and requirements set up under the Center for Medicaid. So what they're going to do is, right now we have, I think the number is 352 individuals in a pre-voc setting on a state level. The majority of these are on the east side of the state. I think there's one entity on the east side of the state that has over 200 individuals in it. People are leaving those settings at about 100 individuals per year. So what they're going to do is close the front door so that new people cannot go into that setting. They're going to take the next 4 years. They're going to do individual person-centered planning with each of those individuals that's in that setting and help them make a transition plan to a service that's appropriate to them and help them identify what that would be, and with the hopes that they would be completely shut down in 4 years.
We're talking about sheltered workshops.
We're talking about sheltered workshops. Mm-hmm. We don't have any sheltered workshops. But this is going to be a big issue because there is a lot of push from the east side of the state. There's going to be some bills introduced this year that we're going to need to address. And our legislators are going to hear a lot about how bad it is to shut down these sheltered workshops. And so we really need to make sure that our legislators understand how Clark County feels on this issue.
I think you just have to put in the back of your mind that the services for the National Federation of the Blind, including those in Washington, are on a mission to get rid of the minimum wage at all costs, and they are going in for the fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So several of the sheltered workshops received, do you want me to talk about that?
Oh, you can.
Okay. Received a letter on the week before Christmas from Disability Rights of Washington, stating whether or not they had the appropriate certification filed with the Department of Labor and Industries for individuals that was making subminimum wage.
It was also group site.
And group sites. And if the appropriate certificates are not in place, they're saying they're going to have to go back and pay the difference between what minimum wage was and what the individual made for the length of time that the individual's been retroactively.
It's going to put it under. And for the group ones, it's actually, it's a mess.
Yeah. And so I don't know what that will mean. There's been a lot of discussion on a state level what the actual outcome of that, but that's the direction that Disability Rights of Washington is pushing. So anyway. There's that. The other changes with Medicaid are our individual and family support waiver. So, sorry, I'm going to bounce back for 1 minute. Please, the paper I handed out to you, this paper, has the website on it. You can go in. You can look at this whole document. You can read more if you want. I will also send the synopsis to Mary so that she can send this out to you as well.
But please go on and make comments. And there's the link there to do that. So the other thing is the Individual and Family Services waiver is set to be, they're submitting it, let me see, Evelyn, Evelyn on Monday, so they're submitting it next week. And so that will be available for public comment as well. They're still on track for that to roll out May 1st. They're going to, it's not going to be a flip of the switch as far as moving people from state-only individual family services to individual family services on a waiver. They're actually going to transition people over at their annual assessment date. Okay.
In spite of the budget?
In spite of the budget, that's what we've been told. Now, the issue is we're on track to still roll out May 1st, but if CMS comes back with any questions at any point in time, it stops the clock. So CMS could drag that out significantly longer. But we've been told that they've been working closely with CMS to come up with the original draft on that individual and family services. The other thing is the Community First Choice Options. I would like to say this is what's happening and this is where it's at in the budget and this is what's going on. And the reality is a lot has changed. CMS has come back and is frustrated with some of the choices. We're having a another task force meeting next week, and I don't have current accurate information to share with you on that. There is, again, with switching over to the Community First Choice, that's Medicaid personal care that will be moved into there. It will give us an extra 6% match. That's $36 million. $18 million of that is assumed in the switchover that it's going to cost to implement that. It leaves an additional $3 million that the governor has absorbed in here. I've been pointing out to legislators that if they want to fund transition services, right there is their $3.5 million they need to fund our students, who then will have jobs, who then can go spend money, who then will get taxpayer tax, sales tax off of, and it will roll forward. They're always wanting to know where to get it. It's right there. That's where you get it. So, and I think that's it for today. Questions? Thank you. Someday I'm going to come give you an exciting, fun information.
That's it.
That's it.
Does each county have one?
There's only one
Darla. Yeah. Well, I know that. But when you go up there to the lip, you're not all there by yourself, right?
No. We have, there's 14 parent coalitions around the state. They serve 17 counties. And we coordinate most of them.
About 50,000 people.
Yeah, we coordinate. We represent about 50,000 families in the state.
When I went up the one time I was able to go up, they had a briefing in the morning. So do they all regularly gather in a place and have
calisthenics?
The parent coalitions who can come to advocacy day do, and they all bring families and different people. So do supported living providers, supported employment providers, People First, self-advocates and leadership. Those advocacy days is a joining of all the community advocates to come together with a common message to move our and to protect our individuals across Washington State and to help move our system forward to best practices.
I think Walt brings it home with transit.
What I'd like to do is give a very extensive report at the next public meeting in March. And the reason why is right now we're in discussions with some community agencies to distribute what is called 5310 New Freedom Funds for some non-traditional transportation options. And so At this point, I can't discuss anything. It's a double secret type of thing. But by the March meeting, we should have most of the negotiations completed, and I think that it will provide some good options for folks and some non-traditional ways of maybe providing transportation outside of C-Trans service area.
So it's good news you're going to bring us.
Yes, unlike Darla, have a tendency to do this good, bad.
Hey, you got lots of smiley faces.
Yeah.
Thank you. That means we adjourn.
Great.